I'm going to call this meeting of the House Committee on Early Childhood and Family Supports to order for Tuesday, February 20, 2018. I'm sure everybody realizes we have but 42 minutes left in this meeting, so while we would like to spend more time, that's all the time we'll have. And so first I will call up the Early Learning Division to talk about staffing and funding. And I'll remind members of the committee, so we passed the Office of Child Care, the whole revamp bill of how we enforce child care and do that. And so this conversation, I just want to repeat the conversation because we're going to get a chance, while we're not the budget committee, we're going to get a chance to hopefully support an effort to support what we passed in the Office of Child Care, that whole revamp and that later. So this would be an important conversation, also just to help set us up for next session and some of the issues we have. So welcome.
For the record, my name is David Mandel. I'm the Policy and Research Director of the Early Learning Division. I appreciate this opportunity to have an encore performance before this committee. So I think you've heard much of this before, so you know we'll be pretty brief. As Chair Lively mentioned, we have a funding request that was submitted by the Governor's Office on behalf of the Early Learning Division. That includes $1.7 million approximately for 14 positions, and Don will go into those positions in more detail, and then about $240,000 to offset the cost of lead testing of water for license-exempt providers receiving subsidy, what we refer to as regulated subsidy providers. I know that we are in a short session, so I think it's also really important to talk about why we're bringing this request to the legislature mid-biennium. You know, I think, as you know, there's been some tragedies in childcare, and as a result of those tragedies, we've also looked at all of our procedures and taken new steps and procedures to strengthen oversight. And we've discussed some of those with you already. There's also going to be new rules requiring testing of water for lead that the council will be adopting actually on Thursday of this week. And I think the final part in timing was, you know, as part of the CCF reauthorization, we started for the first time doing health and safety monitoring for those regulated subsidy providers. We did receive some initial staffing for that in 2015, but to be honest, as we've been doing that work, we're also really seeing its true impact on our caseloads. And with that, I will hand it over to Don to really talk about the request in a little bit more detail.
Go ahead, Don.
Also, Chair Lively, members of the committee, and I apologize for my throat. I think it's my turn, Chair Lively. A little bit of a
scratchy
throat.
We've all had a turn.
So the funding request is kind of grouped into three different types of positions that we're needing after really not only the CCDF reauthorization, but also many of the reform changes that we've been making since 2016, some of which is the statutory House Bill 4065, as moving that forward. So the first part of it is really looking at six additional licensing specialists that would be out in the field. We have eight field offices across the state, and so three of those positions would really be our senior compliance specialists, which really look at providing training to licensing staff. They review the findings and enforcement activities. They're really key in leading case reviews, and they also carry a small caseload. We also really utilize them to help us with consistency. With a staff of about 47 field staff out there, consistency is always something that we're striving to work for, so they really are that extra set of eyes and ears out there with managers, looking at that consistency. And then the other three positions are our compliance specialists too, or again our licensing specialists, and those are really looking to lower the caseloads and increase our ability to do unannounced visits. We know that those unannounced visits is where we can find if there's regular practices of noncompliance. And I think it's just important to remind the committee in terms of that a recommended caseload nationally is 1 to 50. Our current caseload is 1 to 150, and the staffing ask would reduce that to 1 to 38. And I think another important note to these caseloads is that prior to the reauthorization of CCDF, CPF, where we began regulating the regulated subsidy, or those license exempt providers receiving subsidy, our caseloads were at about 1 to 100. So it really has been a significant increase in the number of homes that we're going into.
So, Don, before you move on, so could you just clarify, so who is it that we're licensing? We know there's a wide range of facilities and providers out there. So, and I appreciate it's a large number, whatever it is, but so who is it specifically? Who falls under our purview?
Great. Chair Lively, members of the committee. So we have, we license child care centers, so kind of a traditional child care center. There's a certified family home, which is a larger family home that can care for up to 16 children. There's registered family, which are small homes that can care for up to 10 children. And then our regulated subsidy are legally exempt for licensing because they're caring for three or fewer children. And when you add all those up, that's about 4,500 licensed, with an additional 2,000 some odd of the regulated subsidy are those license exempt. So I'm not a, a significant okay. jump.
Yep. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The other part of this funding request is to increase our management. Currently, we're requesting three additional positions, requesting a licensing director to oversee the day-to-day operations. Currently, I oversee both the quality improvement and the professional development, as well as the licensing, and giving the significant changes that we've been making to our enforcement actions, to our licensing system, really need someone dedicated to implement those changes with my oversight. We need a regional manager in Medford. That's currently an office that's pretty geographically isolated. It doesn't have one of our senior compliance specialists down there. So really, in order to, again, implement our changes, ensure consistency, are needing a manager down there to really lead that supervision. Our current manager does both our Tualatin office as well as the Medford office, so spends a lot of time traveling. Additionally, we are requesting a manager for our central office. This is an office that does our customer service, intakes of paperwork, all of our background checks, and our legal and compliance work. The current manager has 38 staff underneath her. And really needing to reduce that as, again, implementing changes, particularly in our legal and compliance. We need a manager focused on that work, and then to have a subsequent manager under her direction overseeing the intake, background, and customer service components. What we really see this ask is looking at when we think about these nine positions is that really focused oversight of our licensing system, of providing that quality assurance in more review of licensors' actions, really tracking of timely visits and follow-up, and really reviewing data and reports to really look at identifying the patterns and adjust our practices so we can be really nimble and responsive when we start to see a trend or see a training need for a licensing specialist or additional corrective action for a facility. Through that trend analysis, we really need someone directly looking at that. We need successful implementation, again, of all of our new process and procedures, which I don't think there isn't one aspect of licensing where we have not made a significant change over the last 2 years. We need, again, I talked about the consistency. That is always something that we're striving to do and have seen increased consistency with the addition of our compliance specialist three. So with that addition and management, believe that we will continue to see increased consistency. And I think one of the pieces of that consistency and oversight is really digging in deep to the documentation. When we go to a legal hearing, that documentation is critical. So having increased management and supervision can really allow us to look more deeply at the documentation to make sure that we have what we need if we need to take action on a facility. As well as really to provide that management and supervision to support more frequent training for licensing staff. Excuse me. So in addition to those other areas, we're also have been working really closely with DHS, the Child Protective Services Unit, with Dr. Fredrickson. And we have a signed MOU, and we're looking at doing joint investigations when there's an allegation of abuse or neglect in a child care facility. So we're requesting five compliance specialists for this to do these tandem investigations. And what this will really allow us to do, like currently we wait for information to come because we definitely take law enforcement or DHS, who are the experts in assessing child abuse and neglect. We really look at them to give us their results. Well, sometimes there's a timeliness issue and we are looking at different things. So by allowing us to go out simultaneously together, we can look at our prospective regulations and what we're looking at to build stronger cases and have firsthand evidence and really support each other in that investigation.
And then just to go to the next slide. Okay. Yes, to provide a little bit of sort of more context for that, DHS has sort of statutory authority to investigate allegations of child abuse and neglect. They do so in family settings, but they also do so in child care settings. And when there are those investigations are in a child care setting, that really also has important implications for what we're doing and for licensing. And as Dawn was saying, you know, and then we have the authority and the sole responsibility for making sure that child care facilities are following those child care licensing rules and regulations that are also meant to protect the children in a facility. And so what happens right now is basically if there's an allegation of abuse in a child care setting, they'll do their investigation, we sort of wait. And that means that both we don't have the first-hand information or immediate information. And so I think this is a really exciting opportunity to collaborate in a deeper way and also sort of bring mutual perspectives that I think that we bring to those investigations. I think it could be really powerful.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you mind going back to the previous slide?
Yeah.
And forgive me if I missed something. So I couldn't quite figure out if that was five positions or two positions. This is five. Is that the name of the?
Yes, it's okay. Five compliance okay. Specialists, two positions. So compliance specialist two is a type of position.
Okay. So then $100,000 per compliance specialist. Mm-hmm. 100 plus.
Yes, that's correct. That's about when you add in the cost is as well as and the you know, the benefits and all of that. That's about the cost of a staff person in most agencies.
Mm-hmm. And may I ask a follow-up?
Sure,
do you know what we're paying the DHS frontline workers?
Oh, we could get that information from DHS.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can follow
and
up with
and
that.
Basically, these are all established by state classifications of the work.
Is it possible to ask someone in the room who's being pointed to that question? I know we're short on time. Something just doesn't feel balanced to me. I'm sorry.
Would you like me to come up?
Certainly. And Don, I interrupted you before you got to put your name on the record.
Oh.
Sorry. So you need to.
Apologize. For the record, my name is Dawn Woods, and I'm the child care director for the Early Learning Division.
Yes. Good afternoon. My name is Kim Fredlin, and I'm the self-sufficiency director at the Department of Human Services. So classifications, I can't tell you the exact dollar figure of frontline staff, but what I can tell you is the difference in classification mm-hmm. is, I have to do the math in my head really quickly, is about four levels different. So compliance specialists are a higher classification. They're about four levels higher than that. Each level is probably maybe $1,000 a month at the top of the range difference in just the salary. So then again, the additional benefit needs to be added onto that. So this is not out of alignment with what a full-time funded state position would be.
Okay, and I would just remind the committee members, so again, in the bill that we passed went down to Ways and Means, providing different direction for monitoring these facilities. Part of the whole issue there is being able to have the information in a quicker manner in which for the department to be able to act to both protect children or if there's something else going to take corrective action. So the longer it takes to do that, where before the system was they had to complete their investigation and we had to do that. So this is all the attempt to make the whole system work quicker And we appreciate this is a substantial amount of money for the positions. Currently, it's the only path forward from a standpoint of being able to get the information from both directions to make a quicker decision in order to take whatever action is necessary to take.
And I think it's also important to emphasize that we were asking for these as limited duration positions
right.
in order to be able to pilot this and
see
what we learn and ensure that it's actually addressing the needs that it was intended to address.
Sure. Okay.
I think just another kind of point that as we think about this as well is, maybe I shouldn't have started talking, is that oftentimes when we need to wait for a finding, they may, once there's immediate danger, CPS has a different lens, which is within their authority. For us, we're worried about all the children in the center as well. I mean, not that they're not, but, you know, in terms of where our level of effort is. And so having that firsthand, more immediate, allows us to protect more children more quickly.
Thank you.
Did you have anything else to say?
We talked about this already.
Yes. All right. Kind of talked about that.
Yeah.
So again, we now do have a signed IGA with DHS to support this pilot pending the actual funding from the legislature to be able to make this happen.
And we really are teed up to make this happen if we're given these positions, really looking at identifying April 1st, having new staff identified. So we're beginning work teeing this up so that we can really move quickly to do this pilot.
And then, as we mentioned earlier, the Early Learning Council will be adopting rules actually on this Thursday requiring all licensed child care and regulated subsidy facilities to conduct lead testing of water and to take steps to prevent children's exposure to lead. As part of those rules, we're also being required if a test comes back above specified action level, the child care facility will be required to submit a corrective action plan for approval by the and ELD will work in collaboration with OHS to analyze that test data and figure out the appropriate mitigation strategy. For right now, all we are requesting is some funds to support the cost of testing for license-exempt providers receiving subsidy, so not the full set of licensed child care facilities. So, and, you know, these are the least resourced providers serving the most vulnerable families, and so that's why we've asked for that, as well as some funding to sort of help with it, with that work. So this is based on a estimate of $35 per test fixture, estimate of two fixtures for house. We've also been exploring collaborations. Real shout out to Portland Water Bureau, who's really just been a great partner and is offering to do some of this testing for our providers in the metro area for free. So that's not included in that. You know, we've tried to take that out of the $240,000. So we are trying to reduce that cost, but given, you know, really that regulated subsidy providers are operating at the most marginal level, funding level, and serving those vulnerable families, we really thought it was important up front to figure out how to mitigate some of that cost during the testing.
Okay. Questions? I'll make a couple more comments. So one of the questions I continue to ask the serving on the Ways and Means sub is it's not just the current expenditure, but what's our ability to sustain it? So these are critical funds, we should add them, but as everybody knows, 2019 is who knows what. And so I'll continue to explore that from a standpoint, because if we add this and start making great progress and then can do nothing but in 2019 have to make substantial cuts, that's never a good way to sustain a program. The other thing I would say, there are other parts of the Early Learning Division that we did not fund at current service levels in the current budget. Those aren't on the table for you to be discussed, as in other departments, DHS and others, we didn't fund at current service levels, but will be part of the conversation when we would come back in 2019. And so from my standpoint, for policy committee, we just need to keep those things in context, because we're going to be looking at some policies next time, those of us that are here, that will have financial implications above and beyond these that we're already talking here. So this, it doesn't get any simpler, but it's still important that we have the policy discussions and how they relate. So again, I thank you for bringing this back, and we'll see where it ends up. So I'll close informational hearing on the staffing and funds request and open one on employment-related daycare. And so, Kim, you were here once. Please come back. Thank you. And I would just, this is an ongoing topic we're going to be, there's a lot of interest in this particular topic. I think Kim's going to kind of give us an update on where things are at. But I know Representative Hayden and others of us are interested in a broader conversation. So we'll be keying that up probably during the interim and certainly by the time we come back in 2019. So welcome, Kim.
Good afternoon. Again, my name is Kim Fredland, Self-Sufficiency Director at the Department of Human Services. Members of the committee, thank you for having me come and talk about the employment-related daycare program. So I'm just going to quickly, I know we're short on time, I'm going to quickly go through the topics of the caseload, program access, the reservation list. Teen parent contracts and substance abuse disorder contracts. We won't be talking about evaluator reviews. I pulled that out at the last moment. I don't think we're quite ready to talk about that. So as an overview, ERDC is a subsidy program that really helps share the cost of childcare for low-income working families so that they can retain employment while they're working. The program serves at the current funding level approximately 8,200 families a month, which means that it's about 15,000 children. And the income limit, the families need to be below 185% of poverty to be eligible for the program. So our current budget for the program is made up of both general fund and federal funds. The total budget for the program is $159 million, just over $63 million of that is general fund, and $96 million is federal fund. So the for families, the average copay for families is $235 a month on average. Some families it's lower, some families it's higher because it's a sliding scale based on their income and the number of children that they have in the home that are in care. So our average provider payments per month is just, it's about $6.4 million a month that go out directly to providers. So one of the things that we are really challenged with in this program is because it's a budget capped program, we are constantly monitoring the mechanics of how many families do we have receiving care, how expensive is that care, how long are they staying on, how many providers do we have that are providing care and subsidy, and how can we keep it right at that budget cap, because we don't want to underspend and have less families that are getting the service, and we certainly don't want to overspend and have a problem that we would have to come and talk with you about. So the mechanics of that is still a little challenging for us in figuring out how we maintain that cap. Right now, we are about 8,378 families based on the funding, but this changes every single month based on how many families were on the previous month and how much did we actually spend. So it can go a little higher, it can go a little lower. So in the what's not showing on your slide is in the month of October, we were at, and if I put my glasses on, I can read it. We were at 8,600, a little over 8,600 families. The 3 months prior to that, we were averaging about 8,700 families a month. On November 1st, because we were above the cap, we implemented the reservation list with some changes because we knew that the way it had been working previously was not sustainable to close the program to all new applicants. And so when we implemented the reservation list in November, what we did was we said, okay, so every month after, we're going to bring in the number of families that get us up to what that budget cap would be. So for instance, in the month of November, we were at 8,200. We had fallen 400 cases in that 1 month. And so we sent out an invitation, so to speak, to all of the people on the reservation list saying, please apply. So in the month of December, we again dropped another 400 plus cases. And then in January, the number dropped 256 cases. So now we are at a little over 7,500 cases.
When you say it dropped, mm-hmm. meaning that, so the funding you have available would sustain more than that.
Yes.
But that's all that meet the qualifications at that given point and have applied for.
Well, so this is where the challenge comes in, is because we have a reservation list, yeah. what that means is that when someone walks into one of our offices and applies, if the program has a reservation list, they go on the reservation list until they get an invitation to then apply. And so we know that families, if they have to figure it out, they're going to figure it out. And then when we send them the invitation, they may or may not take us up on sure. that invitation. And so that's part of what we're trying to figure out now, is what percentage of those families actually then come back in. Is there, because this is a new process for us, is there a way that we can more quickly get that invitation out to them when we know that we're below that number? At this point, so as you can see, in January we sent 337 invitations, in February 914. Families have about 45 days to let us know if they're going to take us up on that offer. So we're still trying to figure out what is that number that are then coming back in. And so that once we get that information, it'll give us a little more ability to really figure out when do we turn the reservation list off so that the program is just open and accepting everyone, versus when do we need to be more cautious because of the budget cap.
Yes, Representative Bonner.
Thanks, Chair Leavitt. So what do you attribute the decline in numbers to?
Chair Lively and Representative Bonham, I don't think that we know. Certainly what we have seen since November of 2016 is the caseload is a lot more volatile than it was previously. And what happened in 2016 was the changes at the federal level around the providers, the background check, they need to do training in advance before that they can, you know, start taking children. And that has caused a loss of providers overall in the numbers that accept the subsidy cases. And since then, we've seen a lot of volatility in the caseload. What we hear anecdotally from the folks that are working in our field offices is that families are having a hard time finding providers. And so that just makes the problem even worse, that if they're having a hard time finding a provider that will accept the subsidy, it takes longer. It takes longer for them to get on the program. Mm-hmm. So all of those things are happening. And I think that the reservation list in itself is enough of a deterrent that even if somebody's waiting a week or two to get that invitation, that they have figured it out to some degree before that. Mm-hmm. So, well, maybe I should, before I start talking about the teen parent contracts, I think that we're at a place, our team talked at the beginning of February as we were looking at where we are in the caseload, and what we're going to go back and look at an approach of actually shooting above the budget cap. And so we're thinking that even though we're funded at a budget cap of about 8,300, we're going to shoot for closer to 8,900 families. And hopefully, we're watching this month by month to see where we go. And we're thinking that that might get us in a better place to come in as close to that budget neutral spot as we can be. So that's mm-hmm. our plan.
Good luck.
Thanks. So a couple of things that I just wanted to give you an update on is that we transitioned some teen parent services over to DHS self-sufficiency from ELD during this year. And this is really to help teens that are still attending school have that child care subsidy. Those are typically at the school setting. And so we have fully executed all of the contracts at this point. Let's see. So right now we are at About 32 contracts, including 30 school districts. And then we also have a Head Start and the Salvation Army, which are two locations of providers. And so we serve about 240 children, which is not a lot, but we also know how important it is for that parent to be able to finish their education. And so this is not an expensive program, but a really important one that we're adding that continuity for the teens. So the next change that happened is that there was a program that Early Learning was administering that folks that were in a drug and alcohol treatment facility that had the ability for their children to be there and the children to receive child care while they're getting treatment. That also transitioned, and again, those two changes were because of the CCDF or the federal funding rule changes. So that program transitioned over to DHS as well. So we have contracts with 10 substance abuse disorder facilities across the state. And it's a small number, again, about 600 children per year. But one of the things that has been a benefit for us to transition that is that most of these kids are also TANF kids. And so we're able to use that wraparound of our family coaching staff to really engage and make sure that we're really connected with not only the service they're getting at the drug and alcohol facility, but then once they leave and that ongoing plan.
So in these programs, so how does what's the payment rate if we're talking about 600 students or 400 students versus what we do in the general program?
So the payment rate is the same. They would get the same amount. The cost is less because the hours are less that an individual child would need to have the child care in that setting. And one of the things is that because we couldn't use the federal funding, we were actually able to leverage TANF funding to cover this group of kids because otherwise they wouldn't have been able to be covered. And so that's something that we're really happy that we were able to figure out a way to continue that service, because again, it's so important for the kids and the families to get that service and be able to move on.
That's great.
Yeah. Okay. And I think that is it for me. Do you have any questions?
Anybody have any questions? Obviously, it's an ongoing issue is how you balance against the budget.
Yes.
That is there, because we know there's a lot more. The other issue, of course, is the number of facilities that are available that will take the payments.
Yes.
And that's something we'll be talking about later, committee members, about facilities, what we can do to create more opportunities for child care facilities, and not whether they take ERDC or not. But a lot of work to do in this. But we appreciate the update and the work that you and your group do on this effort.
Yes, thank you. I just might add, if I could, that as you're talking about the providers, it is really the rural areas that we are experiencing the most challenge with families being able to access that care. And we've been talking with the Early Learning Division about that. So it's not a surprise to them either, but it's worth mentioning here. So.
Yep, Representative Hayden.
Quick comment.
Yes.
Do you think there might be a connection with the inability to access that care in rural areas with the price structuring that is set forward for the reimbursement for those daycare facilities?
Chair Lively, Representative Hayden, that is outside of my area of expertise, and so I don't have a comment there. I just know that families have a hard time finding providers, and we definitely, again, overall across the state, have seen a decline in providers accepting the subsidy, and that's really been attributed to the changes at the federal level in the requirements that are made up front, because a lot of the rural providers are really friends, family, and neighbors, and they're typically watching, you know, maybe one family's children or maybe two families' children. That they typically have a relationship with them of some sort, and so it's a different setting than a child care facility or a center or such.
So follow-up comment.
Sure, go ahead.
So, well, thank you. I'll address it. I mean, the family issue of friends, families, grandparents, or whatnot creates environment compared to a metropolitan area of about a third of the reimbursement. But if you then step up to if a rural area or outside certain zip codes set up into three different zip codes, which are ironically not the same zip codes that were set by the minimum wage. They are different. I don't know why, since they're both supposedly based on state economies. Even if you have a facility that has achieved their certification, it's still 50 cents on the dollar in rural areas compared to metropolitan areas. So, I mean, this is an issue that needs to be addressed to spread the dollars into particularly our rural areas so that they have access to quality child care also.
And I think if I remember the conversation we had before when we were talking about the formula, the conversation was it's probably time that we take a serious look at it anyway. And so that's on our agenda to do that. But it also raises the issue besides ERDC, what are the other things we might do as a state to make sure that there's access in rural, because it might take a different emphasis.
More opportunity for those facilities to access somebody to do training or to do, I mean, currently my understanding is that from the more metropolitan areas, people travel to do those certificates. There's not somebody embedded in particularly Eastern Oregon, or at least not nearly as many. So it's more difficult for them to just physically have their facilities inspected and communicate for those increased inspections, if you will.
Very good. Anything else? Thanks a lot, Kim, again.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
You bet. So I'll close the informational hearing on employment-related daycare. Our next topic has been scratched for today, but we will be talking about that either later this session, depending on how our schedule works, or during interim legislative days. So if there's nothing more to come before the committee, we'll adjourn.